Hello again. This is Renee Ford Clark for the Georgia Radio Reading Service, continuing with My Nightlife is 24/7 by Fiona Page. This is the seventh reading from this book, which was published in 2011 by Seascape Press. Now, if you remember the last time, Fiona has been talking to us about things that have happened in her life and events that have shaped her personality and gave us some real good insight about who she is as a person and what she's gone through. She has really triumphed in adversity. In our last reading, she is having problems with her voice. Now let's continue. I left Blackshear to be with my family that afternoon. How was I going to communicate without talking? My mother couldn't hear well, and I couldn't see. I remembered the warning about not even whispering. I tried writing notes, but people couldn't read my writing. I spent the holidays sitting at the kitchen table like a chatty cafe doll whose batteries had run out. I returned home glad to be away from the pressure to talk. A few months earlier, I had rented my basement apartment to Marcia, a friend of my mentor, Clyde. She had edited his book. Remember how he spotted me on the airplane and asked the passenger next to me to read aloud, Cancer, The Gift of Life? He had orchestrated our meeting. Since Marcia and I both shared an interest in writing, he thought we needed to get acquainted. I wrote Marcia a note about the doctor's orders. Marcia responded with, Fiona, maybe this is the time to start writing your memoir. I scoffed at the idea. Me, a writer? So many people told me over the years that I should write a book, but I never thought too much about it. It will keep you entertained, she said. I can come up each night and proofread your work. That night as I lay in bed, I thought about what Marcia said. A few days later, feeling better, I sat down to my talking computer and started writing. I had stored up so many stories from the 12 years I had been blind. Could I remember them all? Why hadn't I kept a journal? My fingers flew across the keyboard like they were doing the talking. I poured my heart out and soul every night. The anxiety swelled in my chest as I waited to read Marcia's emailed comments. To hear JAWS, the screen-reading software, speak her words would reveal the answer I sought. Did I have any writing talent? Only time would tell if I had the courage to publish my words. Here we are nearing the end of this journey. You, my new friend, have the option, if you're curious, to read the second part of this book where I share tales of my childhood and those of my family's heritage. The strongest roots of my existence are my heroes, Mama and Grandma Morgan. Everybody needs heroes. You have seen how my life shattered in a short 6 hours. I have learned much in this time as well as being reminded of the things I already knew. Feeling invincible can make you vulnerable and careless. Never burn your bridges. Be careful who you choose as mentors. Persevere. Remember 2 Corinthians 5:7. Live by faith, not by sight. Determination runs deeper than you think. What keeps spouting from my mouth each time I speak to an audience is, we all want to fit in, to belong. Making connections with others and keeping those relationships give us power in the darkest moments. Throughout this book, you've heard me mention the strength and courage of my mother. Her favorite words were, every cloud has a silver lining. Be patient, Fiona. On that momentous night in September, I died on the life flight trip, but God granted me another chance. I believe it was to grow spiritually and help others to see clearly their own true vision. Introduction to Root Causes. This section is important because so many have asked, where do you get your motivation, your drive, your optimism? My mother's spirited courage and no-nonsense attitude about her disability fit me like a glove. The color she painted in her stories falls from my mouth without effort. Storytelling just comes naturally. I wear the same cloak of fearlessness as my maternal grandmother, whom you will meet in Making Eyes. This amazing story tells of two country folk from south of the Mason-Dixon line who find each other amidst genteel society in Virginia. A spark of romance weaves its way through my life in the story of my mother and father's courtship. If I Didn't Care tells their love story. How I hope our descendants will learn to recapture the innocence of that era of my parents' generation. I don't want to think innocence is gone forever. When you read A Dose of Reality, you will understand the fears and thoughts threaded throughout my journey. I have seen the face of prejudice early in my life as the daughter of a handicapped woman, and later in my life as a person with a disability. It is shaded differently now than in the 60s. Then it was blatant in South Georgia, where I grew up. Now it's subtle and disguised, but present nonetheless. In Order Out of Chaos, you will learn about why I am attracted to orderliness. Since as long as I can remember, I have liked things to be orderly. That has come in handy after being blind. What if I was sloppy all of the time? The 12th of Never and Mama Got Liberated at the PW will give you a sense of the way we Morgan women wear our spunk with a touch of rebellion. We are all products of our upbringing, perhaps more than we know. Our family heritage is the fabric of who we are. Through these stories, you may find some answers to the question of what makes Fiona tick. Chapter 1. Making Eyes. The story of Grandma Juliet comes from the snatches of stories I heard as a child. My grandmother was born in 1880 and died in 1941, the year before I was born. She descended from the Harrisons of Virginia and was related to two presidents of the United States, William Henry and Benjamin Harrison. We have a photograph of President Benjamin Harrison, Mama said one day while working in our family store. As a little girl, I was very proud to be related to presidents of our country. The next day, I went to school and bragged about the picture. Your great-grandfather, Jacques de Butte, came to this country from France when he was a very young man. He met his wife at the house of Theodore Harrison, a relative of President Harrison. Grandfather dropped a D in his last name, as many immigrants did in those days. Mama didn't know much about her grandparents because they died before my grandma reached adulthood. Most of what Mama knew came from two sources, family stories and her mother's steamer trunk. Mama stored this musty trunk inside a long closet that connected our two bedrooms. When I was little, I played for hours in that big closet. I remember reading the letters inscribed above the latch of the old trunk. J-U-L-I-E-T-T-E. Opening the trunk, crawling inside, and playing with the magical things it held was a favorite pastime of mine. One day I found a long black taffeta dress and a lonely leather high-buttoned shoe. I tried on both. She must have had the tiniest feet because the shoe nearly fit my little girl foot. Mama started the tale. Your grandmother wore those shoes when she was 17 years old. Where does she get all these postcards? Picking up a stack of cards, I let them cascade down like a waterfall. Photographs of the Taj Mahal and Leaning Tower of Pisa flashed before my eyes. Well, your Uncle Paul left home at 15, I think it was. He joined the Merchant Marines for the adventure. Those postcards were sent to Mother. He wanted her to see the world through his eyes. Do you remember the cuckoo clock he sent last Christmas and the wooden shoes from Holland? I nodded, remembering the fun we had when those presents arrived at our grocery store. That was one of the reasons I liked meeting the mailman. Uncle Paul sent your grandmother a postcard from every seaport he visited. I enjoyed playing with these cards as much as I enjoyed listening to Mama's stories. Those picture postcards took me to faraway places. On another trunk adventure, I found a round pewter pot about the size of a half dollar with a tiny hinged lid. Placing it in my palm, I pinched the thin lid open. Resting on a bed of red velvet was a string of glass beads. I grabbed them and tried pulling them over my head. They didn't fit. Mama took them from me. This is not jewelry, Fiona. These are prayer beads. Your grandmother went to a Catholic school when she was a young girl. Her family was Catholic. What's a Catholic? She smiled. It's a religion. Are we Catholics? No, we're Methodists. I didn't know the difference, but I didn't ask any more questions. Juliet, the youngest of three, lived on a farm in rural eastern Virginia, maybe a day's ride by carriage from the coast. The Morgans had enough food from cultivating the small farm to sustain their family of five, but winters were hard. To support his family, Jacques became a tobacco taster for R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company. Tobacco tasting was an important job. If the tobacco was bitter, the crop was no good. Juliet's mother died from a high fever when Juliet was only 7 years old. We think she died of scarlet fever. Juliet took over her mother's responsibilities, caring for the house and three men. It was up to her brothers to work the farm. Life was about survival in the 1880s, especially for small-time farmers like the Butts. By the time Juliet was 14, her brothers left home to start their own families. She never saw or heard from them again. Life was infinitely more difficult after her brothers left, but Juliet faithfully maintained the garden and kept the housekeeping up for her father. She gathered eggs, milked the cow, and fed the animals. Over the next year, Jacques' eyesight gradually worsened until he reached the point that he could no longer drive the wagon to the Reynolds plantation. His extraordinary ability to determine the quality of the tobacco was known by all, including his boss. Unwilling to lose one of his most valuable employees, Mr. Reynolds sent a carriage to transport Jacques to and from work each day. The fall before Juliet turned 15, her father got whooping cough and his condition weakened. Despondent over his inability to take care of his daughter, Jacques spent the months in bed. He passed away before Juliet's 16th birthday. The frozen winter ground prevented a proper burial, so Juliet had no choice but to wrap her father in blankets and put him in the root cellar until spring. Juliet knew she could not take care of her home all alone. Neighbors were miles away. Recalling her mother's words, "Be proud. You came from good stock, young lady," Juliet knew what to do. She remembered her mother had a brother in Virginia Beach. Juliet had not been there, but she thought it wasn't far. Mother had told her he was wealthy. Perhaps he would be kind enough to help me, she thought. Juliet decided to write her Uncle Ted and ask for his help. Juliet's mother, an educated woman herself, taught her children to read and write. It was rare for country girls to have such a privilege, but education was very important to the Morgans. Writing the letter was the easy part. Getting it delivered in the middle of winter was another matter. She wrote the letter and waited for spring. At the first sign of warm weather, Juliet heard Peddler Joe whistling around the bend and ran down the path to meet him, smiling broadly. He was kind and friendly. He assured her Virginia Beach was on his route to the sea. He would have the letter delivered within the week. Juliet waited patiently, filling her days with chores. After all, she still had to survive. Ted was quite surprised to receive the letter. Concerned for his sister's child, whom he had never met, he made plans to leave immediately. He called his only daughter Jean into his library. "You have a country cousin you'll soon meet." Jean made no comment about her father's plans. He was a serious, no-nonsense man who commanded the household with an iron fist. A little knock on the door took Juliet by surprise. Peeking out the window, she saw a tall, well-dressed, distinguished gentleman standing at her door. Could this be my uncle? Sheepishly, she opened the door of her modest farmhouse. "I am your mother's brother, and you must be Juliet," he said in a firm, deep voice. He took her hand, bowing politely. "Accustomed to taking charge," he said, "we shall leave right away. Pack only what you must, and I have someone arriving tomorrow to dispose of the farm animals and other details." Stunned by his forwardness, Juliet did as she was told. She retrieved her mother's valise from the bedroom and packed a few cherished mementos. Thoughts raced through her mind as she packed the two dresses she owned. "Here is this complete stranger standing in my home orchestrating my future." She was not sure she would like this new life. Closing the door to the only home she had ever known and stepping into her uncle's fine carriage, Juliet felt a tinge of excitement. As the carriage drove away, she turned, peeked through the carriage curtain, and whispered goodbye to her past. After a long silence and several miles, Juliet's uncle spoke. "You, my dear, will learn to be a lady," he said as he looked over his spectacles at her simple dress and shabby shoes. "I will provide for your welfare, including school. You are already enrolled in a fine Catholic school for girls with my daughter Jean. She could never have imagined going to school, let alone life this carriage was taking her toward. Once her uncle finished speaking, Juliet murmured a prayer. "I will hold my head high and do as I am told, Mother." The first order of business would be to get to know her cousin Jean. When the carriage made a sharp turn into the long driveway, Juliet knew she was at the entrance to her new home. An iron fence embraced the lovely gardens of the estate. She could see the kitchen attached to the back of the main house by way of a breezeway. The stately Victorian house rested on a tree-lined cobble street with wooden sidewalks called boardwalks along both sides. A veranda wrapped halfway around the house and was bracketed by two tall, round, pointy roofs on each side. Uncle Ted introduced Juliet to the three servants he employed, a chambermaid, a gardener, and a cook. He explained she was only to speak to these servants when giving them orders. The gardener's smile warmed Juliet's heart. She could not have known how much she would appreciate his smiles, nor could she have known how much his friendliness would come to mean to her. Next, Uncle Ted introduced her cousin, who was just a year older than Juliet. Her father assigned Jean the task of helping her country cousin adjust to city life. Something about her demeanor made Juliet suspect Cousin Jean did not cotton to her new assignment. Juliet followed her cousin upstairs to her room. She noticed each room had a fireplace and the hallways had gas lights. Jean opened the door and stepped aside for her cousin to see. Juliet gasped, "My, I haven't ever seen a roof on a bed before. It's beautiful." Putting her fingers over her lips, Jean smothered her laughter. "Father has arranged for our seamstress to come fit you for two new dresses and a velvet cloak. If you measure up, Father will give you such a wardrobe as I have." Juliet had no idea what it meant to measure up. Juliet's crude homespun dresses and shabby shoes were immediately thrown away. Until she was fitted for her very own wardrobe, Jean let Juliet borrow a couple of her dresses. A few days later, two nice dresses of silk and taffeta arrived along with a pair of leather high-button shoes. Certainly not the kind of apparel a country girl would wear, but giving up her old wardrobe was a blessing. That night, gazing at the fancy clothing her uncle provided, Juliet couldn't imagine wanting more. But then thoughts of home and her mother and father made her pause. Knowing she could not allow herself to dwell on the past, she told herself to stop feeling homesick. "Be thankful for what you have," she whispered. Yet, sitting in her dark room, Juliet longed for her brothers to find her. On Juliet's first day of school, she made her way downstairs, giggling at her squeaky high-button shoes. The giggle stopped a few steps later when she realized the leather squeezed her ankles and hurt her tiny feet. Next, she noticed that her taffeta dress rustled every time she took a step. "I can hardly breathe, all bound up like a rabbit caught in a trap." Her sleeves bound her arms all the way down to her ruffled wrist. Her neck was adorned with stiff lace. Just as Juliet gagged, Jean began to laugh. "Juliet, the lace at your neck is from Spain," she explained with snobbish authority. So many changes. Juliet loved her new dresses, but she still wasn't sure if she was going to like this new life. "I think I want to go to school, but I don't want to be a lady if I have to be a snob like Jean. I like her all right, but I want to be myself." Jean taught Juliet how to wrap her long black hair around her fingers to form curls on top of her head. Pinning a small gray veil hat over her curls, Jean said, "A lady must always shield her eyes in public," said Jean. She handed Juliet a pair of black gloves. "Why do I have to wear gloves? It's not cold." Jean ignored the question. Trying to teach Juliet how to be a lady gave her a sense of superiority. She doubted that anyone could turn this rough lump of coal into a fine diamond. Juliet was determined to make her cousin like her, but turning into a lady was another matter. For now, Juliet didn't mind being bossed around by her cousin. She admired Jean's straightforward manner. At least she knew where she stood. The two cousins finally left the house, walked to the end of the street, and boarded a horse-drawn streetcar. Traveling to catechism classes, they sat in the next to the last bench. The girls made this trip 5 days a week for 2 months. During this time, Juliet finally began to feel like she was getting to know her cousin. Sitting in the back of the streetcar, they whispered to themselves and giggled about the other passengers. Having a little fun together seemed to cement their relationship. One day, a handsome young man took notice of the girls. Something about the attractive, dark-haired young girl intrigued him. He could tell by her comments that she was not an aristocrat, but then neither was he. In business circles, he was referred to as J.S. Morgan, but his friends called him John. He was 29 years old. He had traveled to Virginia Beach from North Carolina to seek his fortune. Although he owned a successful liquor store, he knew few people in Virginia Beach. His goal was to become rich, but he didn't delude himself into thinking he would ever be included in Virginia society. One crisp October morning, Juliet met John Seth Morgan's gaze as he climbed onto the streetcar. She leaned toward Jean and asked, "What do you think of that gentleman over there?" "He is handsome and probably rich." "He does look like quite the successful businessman," Jean said, looking over at him. "How can you tell that?" Juliet asked. "Look at his suit. It's made of fine camel's hair wool, probably imported and tailored just for him. He is not crippled, so the walking stick is a fashion statement. The quality of the stick indicates his station in life. Look at the gold-carved handle," Jean said. "Oh, yes, I think he is definitely rich." Juliet agreed that he did look dignified with his spats over his shoes for protection. Only wealthy men cared about mud splattering from the horse-drawn buggies and carriages. Juliet secretly looked forward to seeing J.S. Morgan on her daily streetcar rides. She loved making eyes with him, a characteristic she would pass along to future generations. Certain that the veil on her hat allowed her to examine his face without him knowing, she would gaze at him unabashedly. His camel-colored bolo had a narrow brim, allowing her to see directly into his vivid blue eyes. But one morning she was forced to look away quickly when she saw the amused look on his face. He had caught her at her little game. If Jean had noticed, she didn't say. J.S. Morgan watched Juliet for a couple of weeks, contemplating what he needed to do to meet her. The societal norms of the time did not allow a stranger to introduce himself to a woman. Only a formal introduction arranged by someone in the ladies' social circle was acceptable. Clearly, these two did not travel in the same circle, so it was unlikely that they would ever meet in an appropriate manner. He knew he had to create a way to initiate an introduction. J.S. soon came up with a clever plan and put it into action one afternoon. He boarded the streetcar and sat on the back row behind the girl's favorite seat. When Juliet saw J.S. seated directly behind her regular seat, she glanced up, fluttering her eyelashes. She gave him a demure smile before sitting next to her cousin. He tipped his hat as he did every day and waited patiently for the girls to begin their schoolgirl chatter. Certain they were adequately distracted from his presence, he began using the tip of his cane to carefully snag a loose strand of Juliet's hair from under her hat. J.S. proceeded to meticulously attach the long strand to the streetcar cable used to signal her stop. As Jean reached for the cable, she caught a glimpse of the gentleman behind her. His smile confirmed her suspicions, and she was on to his secret. When Juliet stood up, she felt a tug. Next thing she knew, her hat fell off. Startled, she fell backwards. Waiting with open arms, J.S. caught her, gallantly retrieved her hat, and introduced himself. Jean jerked Juliet away before she had time to tell him her name. Undaunted, J.S. Morgan followed the girls off the streetcar, keeping a respectable distance. Juliet let Jean open the gate outside the estate while she stole a glance to see if the handsome young man was nearby. He grinned when she met his gaze. Giggling, Juliet rushed in the door behind Jean and ran to the front window. "What are you doing? Father will be furious." Juliet didn't care. Looking outside, she saw the gentleman motion the old gardener over to the gate. The two spoke and exchanged something. What did he hand to the old gardener? Juliet brushed past her cousin, avoiding her curious stare, and rushed upstairs. She shut her door, breathless and excited. Her heart was thumping wildly. Could he? Would he? Did he write something to her? Later that evening, the gardener knocked on her door with the nightly firewood delivery. She opened her door and immediately noticed a twinkle in his eyes. "Mr. Morgan paid me 50 cents to deliver this note, Miss Juliet." She thought her heart would jump out of her bosom. Never before had she been so thankful that her mother taught her to read and write. For the next 2 months, the old man conspired, delivering daily passionate letters between J.S. and Juliet. It didn't hurt that he was paid well. Every night at midnight, Juliet locked her bedroom door to read the precious letters from her beloved J.S. Juliet kept up this charade because she could not afford to trust Jean with her secret. John Seth Morgan proposed eloquently in his letters to his sweet Juliet, and she replied with a profound yes. They had never touched, kissed, or even uttered each other's names, but they could not wait to be together. Knowing her uncle would never allow them a proper courtship, they decided to elope. In his 31st letter, John outlined their runaway plans. Late one November night, Juliet packed her valise with a few of her mother's things. The only outfit she took was what she had on, the taffeta and lace black one and leather high-button shoes. Opening the window, she leaned out and began trilling like a small bird to signal her lover. When she heard his responding low whistle, Juliet climbed out the window and landed on the roof below. She quietly slid her valise over the edge where John was waiting. Crawling on her stomach, she inched across the tin roof toward the drainpipe. Swinging the rustling skirts over the pipe, the lovers touched for the first time. "John Seth," she whispered as he swept her into his waiting arms. A driver and black carriage were waiting at the street corner to whisk them away. John arranged for a friend of his to marry them. The judge's house was only a block away. He also rented a small house not far from his liquor store. That night they settled into their tiny love nest, happy as two lovebirds. Juliet's first order of business was to contact her uncle. He had been so kind to take her in after her father died. She did not want to be ungrateful. She only wanted to be with her husband. After spending several hours trying to pen the letter, she finally settled on a brief note. The damage was done. If he was angry, there was nothing she could do. "Dear Uncle Ted, I cannot find the words to express my gratitude for your kindness and generosity. Please understand and know that I am safe and happily married to Mr. John Seth Morgan." Unfortunately, Ted heard about the elopement before receiving the letter. He was furious. John's property manager informed him that Ted Harrison owned the warehouse he rented for his business and was not pleased to know Juliet's husband was selling liquor out of it. How long would it be before he asked John to move? When news of this fury reached the Morgans, John told Juliet it would be best for them to move. "Your uncle could make trouble for us. He is a very influential man." Juliet wondered, what kind of trouble could her Uncle Ted make for them? That Saturday, John closed shop at 9 in the evening and walked home. They didn't live far, 4 blocks. The night was clear and cold with a bright full moon. 2 men dressed in dark clothing surprised John from behind. They hit him over the head with a blunt object, and he fell into a heap under a willow tree. "He's dead," groaned one of the thugs. "Let's get out of here before someone comes." Grabbing what they could from the body, they fled. Luckily, John's Saturday night helper had locked up the warehouse shortly after John left and was headed home along the same path. Snow was a huge black man with snow-white hair and a gimp leg from the war. A black man might have been afraid to stop when he saw a white man lying on the ground, but Snow thought he recognized the clothes. "Mr. John, is that you? Are you all right?" Snow bent down to see if he was breathing. His boss was unconscious, lying on the ground under the willow tree in a pool of his own blood. Snow quickly hoisted him onto his back and carried him home. As John recovered, Juliet expressed how frightened she was by the incident. She had so many questions. Was it possible John just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time? A coincidence? Did her uncle arrange this? And if he did, how could he do such a horrible thing? It was unthinkable. John was right. They needed to move away from Virginia Beach. It didn't take long for him to convince Juliet that Atlanta, Georgia, was a new city full of opportunity. Once again, they left under the cover of darkness. This time, they would travel a long time. After many detours and a year on the road, John fulfilled his promise. But that's another story for another time. Chapter 2, If I Didn't Care. Our mother was a successful businesswoman most of her life. In fact, she ran her own tax preparation business until she was 80 years old. But her number one priority was taking care of Daddy and her two daughters. Daddy was the wind beneath Mama's wings. He saw her in very special qualities, strength, determination, and conviction. I believe he was blind to her disability. My sister and I know we had very special parents. They loved each other for 50 years. Daddy died in November after that 50th wedding anniversary. Mama died 16 years after Daddy. In October 2009, our family home was demolished in Blackshear, Georgia. Daddy built that house in 1962 on the same property where my grandparents' house once stood. My sister called to tell me they found Mama's love letters to Daddy in the walls of our childhood home. I guess he put them behind the walls for safekeeping. This is their love story. In 1939, Kenny Graham sputtered into Waycross with $5 in his pocket and one last gift box of sculptured rose-scented soap in his trunk. The Depression had pushed many young men to join public work relief programs established by President Franklin D. Roosevelt. With no jobs available, Kenny joined the Civilian Conservation Corps for a while. He sent most of his earnings home to help support his three younger sisters. This didn't last long, though. He decided to seek his fortune by jumping the rails and joining the hobos. Kenny landed in southern Texas, where he met up with two Jewish fellows. Impressed by how they could sell anything, Kenny persuaded them to teach him their spiel. After that, he became a traveling salesman. As soon as he made enough money, Kenny bought an old jalopy. He discovered he was good at door-to-door sales. He called on the farmers' wives around Texas and Missouri, offering them a free box of decorative rose soap just for trying out Procter & Gamble's new Oxidol washing powder. Never mind that most of the farm women didn't have newfangled washing machines to use the soap powder. They were delighted to get a free gift just for trying it out. Folks welcomed strangers because they didn't have much company living on large country farms. They didn't have a reason to be suspicious or afraid. Kenny was a nice-looking fella. He had a Cary Grant look about him with his dark hair swept over fashionably, his heavy brows hooded twinkly, deep-set brown eyes and a charming grin which disarmed many a lady. Working his way east, Kenny sold soap door-to-door from Texas to Georgia. When he arrived in Waycross, he noticed a big sign advertising Miss Irene's boarding house, home of good southern cooking. Kenny decided this would be a good place to rent a room and have a Sunday dinner. Stepping inside, Kenny flipped his gray fedora onto the hat rack. He glanced around at the crowded long tables, looking for an open seat. Trying to decide where to sit, his eyes fell on two attractive young ladies. Kenny sat down next to the redhead, the prettier one. If you have ever heard of the boarding house reach, it means having long arms enough to reach the large bowls of delicious fried chicken and mashed potatoes. You more than likely would sit next to a stranger or a neighbor. It was like eating at a school lunchroom with all the food already on the table, only this was home-cooked goodness. Reaching for a biscuit, he tried to introduce himself. They glanced up for a second before resuming their conversation. He was never at a loss for words, but the two young ladies politely passed the bowls while continuing their gossip. While eavesdropping on their conversation, Kenny gathered that the girl sitting next to him was named Nanette, and the other was her sister Berta. They were talking about Nanette's best friend, Nana. The conversation went like this. Imagine being featured in a syndicated newspaper column like Ripley's Believe It or Not, Nanette said. Our girlfriend might become famous, Berta replied. Nana says that Greyhound wants top billing, whatever that means, Nanette continued. Well, she is their employee, you know. I guess they are entitled to tell her what they want. Having your legs amputated is no easy way to get publicity. Are you sure Nana will do this? Nanette hesitated. This pause gave Kenny an opportunity to jump in. Pardon me, ladies, I'm curious. Don't mean to be rude, but what happened to your friend's legs? Nanette passed the biscuits again, ignoring his question. Kenny got the message, so he ate quietly and tried to listen for more details about Nana. He didn't listen closely, though, and missed that part about Nana getting two wooden legs at the age of 14. Ripley's indeed wanted Miss Nana featured in their museum. They recently interviewed her for the Ripley's Believe It or Not newspaper column. No female had been known to have such a birth defect. Her legs were severely crippled. One was missing a small bone, and both feet curved inward. They were impossible to stand on, so she crawled most of her life. When she was 13 years old, she asked her mother to find someone to remove her useless legs. Her mother searched until she found Dr. Michael Hoke at Piedmont Hospital in Atlanta. Dr. Hoke was well known for a new development called prosthesis. Nana was told she was the first woman to walk on two wooden legs, and Ripley's wanted to share her story. Although Kenny read the popular syndicated newspaper column, he had never heard of Nana. Was she so odd that Ripley's would make a wax figure out of her for their museum? Not making much headway with his flirting, Kenny decided to take a walk. His old car was on its last legs, which might cause him to be in Waycross until he figured out a plan. It appeared that this Yankee was stuck in the Deep South. What else could he do? Remembering that Berta mentioned Nana worked at the Greyhound bus station, Kenny decided to walk there first. He could see it was just a few blocks away. He hoped he might get there to meet this incredible gal. She must have such a difficult life, he thought. Until President Franklin D. Roosevelt's time, a person with a disability was rarely seen in public. Even he did not allow himself to be filmed in a wheelchair. People with severe distortions were hidden away at home or in sanitations. Some even joined a carnival freak show. Kenny found the bus depot crowded with men in uniforms. War had broken out in Europe. Many feared the U.S. would enter the war soon. All service branches were calling in their reserves. Kenny strode around the bus terminal looking for the crippled girl. He expected she might have a platform on wheels to get around. What kind of work would a handicapped person do, especially one with no legs? After nosing around, Kenny went to the lunch counter, ordered a cup of coffee, and began watching the people. As he scanned the crowd, his eyes locked with a pair of sparkling green eyes. Wow! What a looker! She looks about 24 years old, like me! As he stared, she glanced up from behind the ticket counter and flashed him an inviting smile. This was his chance. He sauntered over and took his place in line. When his turn came, he cleared his throat and asked, "When's the next bus to Peoria, Illinois?" "The bus you want just left about an hour ago," she replied. Kenny felt the chemistry sizzle with his cute little brunette, even though she was all business. He was convinced she would go out with him if he persisted. His original mission to find Nana was forgotten. This young Yankee would get a date with this babe for sure. All he had to do was come up with another city to inquire about and get back in line. The ticket agent did not have time for this foolishness. After three tries, she was terse with him. "Are you sure you know where you want to go, mister?" "I want to go to dinner with you, sweetheart," he replied with a big grin. "Get lost, buddy. I'm busy here, and you are holding up the line." His hopes were not squashed. Kenny started plugging nickels in the jukebox, playing his favorite song, "If I Didn't Care," by the Inkspots, grinning every time she looked his way. He left that afternoon and returned the next day. Once again, Kenny got in line. "How about dinner, doll?" he asked. She was annoyed, but a little intrigued with his persistence. He was obviously not going away. Warming to his charm, she agreed to meet him after work. Maybe this guy would be fun, she thought. So Kenny waited at the lunch counter until 5 o'clock. To kill time, he started pumping the waitress for information about his future date. He didn't even know her name. The gal behind the counter looked a little like Bugs Bunny. When she told him her name was Bugs Murray, he didn't ask why. No need to. Kenny was in luck. Bugs loved to gossip, and she knew his 5 o'clock date by name. I forgot to ask this doll her name. Do you know it? Yep, it's Nana, Bugs replied. Not the Nana with no legs, he blurted, but she's too tall. Bugs laughed. You've been flirting with her all afternoon, mister. She got a picture in the Florida Times Union recently. No joke. Ripley's, believe it or not, wants her to be in their museum because she has 2 artificial legs. She let a doctor amputate them when she was 13. Until she got a wooden leg, she couldn't stand up. When they handed her crutches, she just crossed her arms and said, "If I have to use crutches, you can just have these legs back." "Is that so?" said Kenny. "You know what? She learned to walk without them crutches." Bugs beamed proudly as though she had some stake in it. "Wow." Kenny was fascinated. He couldn't wait to get to know this remarkable gal. At 5 o'clock, Kenny anxiously waited outside the depot for his date. Leaning against his jalopy, he watched as the door to the office opened. Nana walked out a little stiffly, but Kenny didn't notice. He was smitten. Out of nowhere, 2 huge bus drivers swooped up Nana and put her on the waiting bus. She never had a chance to protest. Kenny was stunned. Who were these men, and why did they put Nana on the bus? The next day, Kenny returned to the bus depot with a pocket full of nickels. He spent the early part of the day putting money into the jukebox, waiting for Nana to talk to him. His persistence paid off. When they spoke, she answered some of his questions about the previous day. Kenny learned Nana had a boyfriend, and that the bus drivers who whisked her onto the bus were her boyfriend's buddies. That was the bus she took each day to her parents' house in Blackshear. Despite this news of a boyfriend, Kenny didn't give up. He came back every day for a week until he wore her down with his charm. The boyfriend soon became history. For 6 months, Kenny and Nana were a hot item. Nana introduced him to all her friends, even her buddy Hoover, who was one of the bus drivers. For the next few months, Nana did what she could to help Kenny find a job. He finally found work in Augusta, about 150 miles north of Blackshear. The young couple tried their best to stay in touch by writing letters to each other. They created their very own delivery system using the bus route to and from Augusta. Nana's bus driver friends diligently delivered every single letter, including the one where Kenny proposed. Immediately after receiving his proposal, Nana quit the bus station and saw to it that Kenny got her job. They planned to marry on March 23, 1940. Nana bought her peignoir and pillbox hat with a veil at the fashion shop. She loved pretty clothes, especially lingerie. Nana made her own navy blue wedding suit in 2 days. She had sewn most of her own clothes since she was a teenager. Nana knew it wouldn't be easy telling her parents, especially her father, about her engagement. He had not approved of his crippled daughter accepting the college scholarship to become a legal secretary. Now she wanted to marry this Yankee stranger? But she desperately wanted her father's approval. It was important to her that her parents be there on her wedding day. When it came time to tell her parents, she threw her fox fur scarf around her shoulders, marched into their living room, and asked boldly, "Papa, Mama, I'm getting married this afternoon, and I want you to be there with me." Her father frowned in dismay. "I have always taken care of you. When a family member has an affliction, it is the father's duty to see to it that his loved one is cared for. I do not approve of this marriage." "Not to mention he's a Yankee." Nana's mother silently stood by her husband. Years ago, she had searched for medical help for her daughter. Her husband did not participate in this, but he did not stop her. Now she felt she had to defer to his wishes, even though she longed to be at her daughter's wedding. That fateful day, Kenny and Nana walked out of her childhood home on Highway 82 and hitchhiked the 9 miles to the First Baptist Church in Waycross. Red, a cab driver friend, saw them all dressed up walking down the street and hollered, "Where you going?" "To get married." "Hop in. I'll give you a ride." After driving them the last block to the church, he joined them as their witness. After the ceremony, the newlyweds met up with some friends to celebrate at the Blackshear Bowl, a local night spot. At the end of the night, one of their buddies asked, "Where can I drop you off?" "Home, James," Nana retorted. Yes, Nana took her bridegroom to her parents' two-bedroom stucco home on Highway 82. The bedrooms were joined by a bathroom and a large closet. You could walk all the way through the closet to get from one bedroom to another. They crept noiselessly into Nana's room, trying not to wake her parents. Kenny undressed in the adjoining closet while her parents unknowingly slept. Nana slipped into her lovely white peignoir, propped her artificial legs next to the bed, and transferred herself from the wheelchair she kept in the room to the bed. Kenny stepped out of the closet humming his favorite song, "If I Didn't Care." Ready for bed, he winked and said, "Sweetheart, I am your loving husband here to take care of you for the rest of our lives." He wrapped his arms around her and said, "Now let's take off that cute little hat." Our family was very open and loved to joke. My sister and I would giggle when Mama teased Daddy about undressing in the closet on their wedding night. Daddy would kid her about the hat. We grew up hearing them tease each other. But it is true. Kenny Graham took care of his bride Nana for 50 years, right there on Highway Avenue. My grandfather brought his family, 3 children and his wife, to Blackshear in 1916 after reading about the almost tropical climate. He purchased the property where he built his house and grocery store. Mom and Daddy took over the business when my grandmother died suddenly. A year later, my grandfather had a stroke. The stern man who declared, "We take care of our own," found himself being taken care of by his Yankee son-in-law. The fickle finger of fate dealt him this irony. After almost 40 years of service, the grocery store closed in 1955. My parents reopened it in 1957 as a soft ice cream store, and it eventually evolved into a family-style restaurant. When my brother-in-law joined the family, it became known as Graham Sackless Restaurant and Dairy Cream. The restaurant was open from 1957 until 1985. Daddy preceded Mama by 16 years in reaching those heavenly gates. She left us when she was 94 years old. At both their funerals, the men and women who had either been an employee or a patron of their business stood up to share the memories and respect for our Mama and Daddy. We could not have been prouder. Chapter 3, 12th of Never. Blackshear, Georgia, in 1955, was much like a southern version of Happy Days, the popular 1970s TV show. My hometown had a population of only about 6,000. Even so, we called ourselves City Slickers. We lived next door to Morgan Grocery, the store Mama inherited from my grandfather. Our white stucco house with lavender-blue trim and the matching grocery store was located on Highway 82, the main street in town. When I was young, I enjoyed sitting on the fence watching cars and trucks whiz by me. After puberty hit, though, I preferred watching boys. Some of my favorite memories are from when I was a preteen. My life consisted of cheerleading, playing basketball, roller skating, and going to the movies on Saturday and Sunday afternoons. I could walk to the Royal Theater in town, but I was required to drag my little sister along as my chaperone, and that was annoying. My parents were smart cookies. They enclosed the front porch of our house to create a dance floor for me and my seventh-grade friends. This was a shrewd move. Being 12 and a truly red-blooded girl, they could see me becoming boy crazy. My parents' attempt to keep my social life under watchful eyes was brilliant, but they couldn't keep me hemmed in all the time. Growing up too fast, the downtown drugstore became my new playpen. Traditionally, high school kids hung out at the drugstore. We had 2, one on each corner, separated by railroad tracks. The juniors and seniors hung out at McGregor's, and the freshmen and sophomores hung out across the tracks at Morell's. My goal was to be the center of any social gathering. We girls who lived in town had more opportunities to get together. Yet I had friends who lived out in the country, too. We all socialized at school, but those who lived on farms didn't get to do as much as us in-town folk. I loved visiting my girlfriend's farms. One of my favorite adventures was going to Emily's house to pick peanuts and watch television. My family didn't have a TV set yet. Emily had television. I had the drugstore hangout. I wondered if Emily and the other farm kids envied me as they passed the drugstores in the afternoons. Did they gaze out the bus window and long to be there, too? Main Street Junior High was a sprawling old brick building, probably built before World War II. The high school was a two-story pre-World War I red brick building, which my mother attended in the early 20s. The two schools were a block away from each other. The main street of our little town was teeming with kids at 3 o'clock when the school bell rang for dismissal. After school, the eighth graders scurried like insects for the sidewalks to town. Hordes of teenagers jammed the 3-foot sidewalks with one thing in mind, ice-cold Coke. The bus kids hung out the windows, waving and hollering at their friends. We loved to walk the 3 blocks to Morrill's drugstore. We must have looked like any army of ants as we piled into the store. The owner cowered in the recesses of the store like he was afraid of us. We never noticed. We were only interested in getting there first to claim a seat on the chrome and nugget-hide bar stools. Couples opted for the wide, sweetheart-shaped chairs and round tables. Everybody's mouths were watering for an ice-cold fountain drink or an ice cream sundae. Few of us had the money for anything more than a 5-cent Coke and a pack of crackers. The railroad track gang was not a gang in the sense of today's culture, but the clusters of kids who lived close to the tracks and walked to school together. Daddy drove a school bus. Sometimes on chilly mornings, I got up early and rode the route with him. I flirted with the cute farm boys as they swaggered down the bus aisle. In warm weather, I walked the mile and a half to school with the railroad track gang. I had my eye on high school-age twins Ronald and Donald. They were almost 16. They took me under their wings, saying they would look after me. We teased and joked. Some days Ronald worked after school bagging groceries, so I walked with Donald. I confided with him that I had a crush on his twin. Ronald was a hunka-hunka, varsity quarterback, short but strong. When fall came, I joined the 8th grade cheerleading squad. This gave me the privilege of riding on the athletic bus to the games with Ronald. His thick blonde hair fell over his ocean blue eyes. I swooned and fell head over heels for him. Before long, Ronald and I were going steady. High school got out 10 minutes earlier, so he would walk to the end of the junior high sidewalk and wait for me. Kids teased Ronald about liking an 8th grader, but he never let on that it bothered him. We walked to Morrell's together. Ronald found us a table and held out the chair for me. Such a gentleman. Just like in the movies, I stole a glance at him. Imagine me with a high school boyfriend, I thought. Grinning at me, I could see his pearly white straight teeth. He looked sharp, dressed in a white button-down shirt, khakis, and dark brown leather lace-up shoes. He reminded me of the movie star Alan Ladd in Shane. We bent forward, heads touching, sipping soda. 2 straws in 1 Coca-Cola glass, holding hands under the table. Someone had always a nickel or two to play the jukebox. Elvis Presley was the hottest sensation around. I had seen him once on the Ed Sullivan Show. With my eyes closed, I listened to Elvis croon, "Love Me Tender." Jerking me back to reality, Ronald asked, "How about a banana split?" "Wow," I exclaimed, "a banana split costs 35 cents, half of 1 hour of Ronald's wage." He ordered the split. We hurried through it because my mother didn't like me dallying too long. On our way home, he walked through the park to the railroad tracks. It was fun to try to balance on the rails, 1 foot in front of the other. As the track stretched towards Waycross, it cut deeper into the rise of the road. It was hard clay going straight up about 10 feet as we neared his house. Climbing out of the embankment was not an easy feat for me in my calico full skirt and crinolines. I thought I looked like Marilyn Monroe in it. A woman never forgets her first high heels, tight skirt, or bra. It would be even tougher when it got cold enough for me to wear the 1 store-bought straight skirt I owned. The Thomas's yard was like ours, no grass, just sandy soil. Ronald and I spent many hours standing in his yard until Mrs. Thomas called out that my mother was looking for me. Often I was barefoot, holding my ballerina slippers in my hand while twirling my toes in the sand. Ronald would then walk me the rest of the way home. My parents enjoyed having Ronald around. They knew the Thomases were good boys. I always thought Mama approved of Ronald because she graduated from high school with his daddy. Mr. Thomas was a rural mail carrier. The two of them joked around and had been good buddies all their lives. That made it okay for me to spend a lot of time at the Thomas's house. Ronald and I met every Friday at the skating rink a few miles down the road between Blackshear and Waycross. I loved the warm, balmy days at the rink. The crude, hinged half walls folded back for the boys who came not for the skating but for the girl watching. This was the only kind of air conditioning available. The place wasn't too much to look at. It hadn't been painted in years. But memories were made of this. Some farm boys borrowed their dad's trucks and gathered around the ledge outside the ring to watch the girls skate. They would siphon off just enough gas from their daddy's farm tractor to get to the skating rink on Friday and Saturday nights. They leaned on the lower half walls and gawked at the cute girls as the song "I'm a Girl Watcher" blared over the loudspeaker. Teenage boys showed up from the five surrounding counties to do just this. Those were the guys who couldn't skate or thought they were too macho to try. The lucky guys who were experienced skaters embraced the girls and circled the rink in time to the music. Some even showed off their dance tricks. But when they only had enough money for gas, at 10 cents a gallon, there was always girl watching with the farm boys. When it wasn't football season, I tried my best to never miss a Friday at the roller rink. If I could scrounge up enough money, I would go both Friday and Saturday night. I wasn't old enough to date yet, so we girls had to talk our fathers into dropping us off at the skate rink to flirt. That didn't mean just flirting with Ronald. It was open season. Any guy was fair game. The best part of the evening was skating around the oval rink and smiling coyly at the cutest boys. Sometimes a breeze would rush through the rink, flipping up my short skate skirt. I imagined I was a skating star. I wasn't very good at backward skating, but I tried anyway. Sometimes I lost my balance, tipping over a bit. This revealed the bloomers that just matched the color of the gold lining of my short skating skirt. All this was a tactic to get attention. I admit it, I was weaned on chick flicks. Piper Laurie, Janet Leigh, and Doris Day were my heroes. I dreamed about being an actress all the time. I certainly didn't connect flirting with sex because we were clueless in those days. Nothing of a sexual nature was ever on television. It was a wholesome time when propriety and courtesy were important to a girl's reputation. That summer in 1957, I was almost 14. It was easy to slip into a car dating with Ronald because my family trusted him. Well, our time is up for today. I hope you can join me next time when we continue with My Nightlife is 24/7 by Fiona Page. This has been Renee Ford Clark for GARS, the Georgia Radio Reading Service.